Đây của xe của cô ấy cũng hỏi được cái tụng cá chất cái nó stock cái đi qua tụng cá đây cái my name is Clifton Nicholas. What I just finished saying was a welcome to you to my territory, and I introduced myself as being from Kanasatake. It's been about 5 years since I've done this. I've taken a hiatus for personal reasons, so now I've decided I guess it's a good time as any to get back now that I've cleared my mind a bit. It's great to be here. I'd like to thank Tadman and SPHR and organizers of this event. Very grateful that we're able to gather here and discuss this situation that is currently ongoing both here on in North America and in Palestine. Whereas, like we say in my language, which is the Great Turtle Island. Anyways, I have to focus myself here. I'm sorry. Little bit of the jitters. I guess it. Aaron said a lot of what I wanted to say there. It was basically like a lot of people in North America tend to forget that what's occurring currently in Palestine has its roots here in Canada. And in fact, a lot of that apartheid system that you see going on now in Palestine has its origins here in Montreal, at McGill University to be particular, and at Queen's University. These were the people who drafted the laws to begin the process of creating an apartheid state out of Canada. And the models for that apartheid, the models that were used in South Africa originated over here. The reservation system was given in Canada was given inspiration by the reservation system in the United States, and it worked hand in hand to create what they had now as apartheid in South Africa. In my community, we've had a long history of resistance to Canadian colonialism. It has gone on for over 270 years. It's going on 280 years now, actually, more than that, 290 years, because it was 270 years in 1990. It was 290 years now. Originally, my people, the Ganyokahaga people, inhabited what we call Jojaga, which is what your people call Montreal. And we were the people that greeted Jacques Cartier on his voyage, one of his voyages into what he called, his first voyage actually, into what he called Canada, or Canada. In our language, Canada means village. That's how we figured out where he was. He came into the village and he asked the people, "Where am I?" "Well, you're in the village here, Canada." Then he went on and called it Canada. Anyways, those were my ancestors that were there. So once the settlers came here to create a colony in what they called New France, they began marginalizing our people right away through Christianity, through the introduction of capitalism and so on, with the fur trade. And we were taken and we were put into missions in the north end of Montreal. And from the north end of Montreal, we moved into where we are now in Kanasatake. And it has been a never-ending struggle in that community for justice and for just the right to live and exist in peace. In about 1890, we began to truly struggle physically with the Sulpicians, which is an order of the Catholic Church that was running the mission in Kanasatake, for our right to grow crops, to cut wood, and to live in our community. And what they did, and I think it's something the Palestinians can relate to, is they began the first deportations of people in Kanasatake. What had happened, what sparked that deportation, was the imposition of Catholicism within the community. And like I had mentioned, the Sulpicians were the people who were basically running the show at the time. These are the people who own the Notre Dame de Neige Cathedral in Old Montreal, and they're supposed to be the owners of Montreal. They were supposed to be the largest landowning order of the Catholic Church in Canada. Well, these were the same people that were in Kanasatake. And what happened was, in order to protest, there were many natives in Kanasatake who aligned themselves with different activist groups in Montreal, Montreal has its own history of activism also, which I won't get into right now. There were many activist groups in Montreal, and they happened to be Methodists. And at the time of this, confrontation, I'd like to say, I'd like to call it, these Methodists helped create a Methodist church within Ganasadaga. You have to understand the context of that. It may sound really ridiculous today that, you know, like, well, they're Methodist and Catholic, they're both Christian. But that it was deeper than that. There was a big divide between the Catholic community and the Protestant community within Quebec particularly. And I think this is something that goes like back to Henry VIII and all that crap and Martin Luther and the Reformation. But I'm not going to get into that. That's like here or there. But anyways, what they did is they had a mass conversion of the people in Ganasadaga into Methodism from Catholicism. And in doing so, they built a church within the village of Oka, a Methodist church. That's not to say there weren't traditional people there. I'm kind of like jumping around people, but you have to understand, like, very complicated story, and I'm trying to compress this into a 15-minute presentation. But anyways, in doing so, they built this church in the village of Oka. And upon the completion of this church, the Sulpicians had the aldermen of the church and the Quebec police go there and demolish the church. And in response, the Mohawks in Ganasadaga went and burnt the Catholic church and had the first Oka crisis. That was 1875. And out of that Oka crisis, that first Oka crisis, what happened was they petitioned the Canadian government. And you have to remember, the Indian Act had not been enacted yet. It was still in its formative stages. And one of the first actions that came out of the Indian Act was relocation, as they like to call it. I like to call it deportation of the Ganasadaga Mohawk people from Ganasadaga to Northern Ontario, around the Muskoka region of northern, just north of Toronto. And they had made promises to these people that if they willfully relocate there, that they'll have land that they can grow potatoes the size of an infant's head. And that, you know, they can create fields of, you know, honey and gold, you know. It was something that was so great that they were going to. So some of the people willingly went. A lot of other people had no choice. They were forcibly dislocated from their community and sent there. And upon arriving there, if anybody's familiar with the geography of North America, they'll know that in that area of Ontario and in northern Quebec, it's Canadian Shield. There's about 2 inches of really poor topsoil, and there was no way of farming. And Mohawk people who are agrarian people, we've depended on farming for thousands of years. This was our form of subsistence. We weren't hunters. You know, people have that notion that everybody hunted. You know, all Native people hunted. It's not true. The majority of Native people were farmers, and including the Mohawks. So when they went there, they realized that they couldn't grow their crops in this land. Many people attempted to come back. When they came back, what they discovered were non-Native people living in their houses, non-Native people living on their land. I think Palestinians can relate to that. Maybe not some of the Palestinians here, but their elders can relate to what happened with that, being removed and trying to come back and having nothing to come back to. Ganasadaga Eron, which is what I'm from, we can relate to that. We know what that is. We've had to deal with that now for like over 100 years with that particular situation of having to resist, you know, these people, these settlers coming in, dealing with settler culture in Ganasadaga. There are some faces here that I know from the Palestinian community that have been in Ganasadaga, and they know what we're talking about. In 1990, again, that whole issue of land and the conflict that surrounded the land came to a boiling point again. And this time around, they were threatening our dead. Like, we weren't even allowed to be dead in peace. What they wanted to do was expropriate our cemetery, exhume the bodies and put them in a common grave, and make a parking lot to expand a golf course through our pine forest, which we planted in the area where we call the pines, which is just, northwest of the village of Oka. That's where the name Ganasadaga originates from. It's called the Hill of Sand. And at one point it was all sand and there was a lot of erosion, so we planted the trees there to prevent the sand from going down in the spring with the runoff and going into the village. Our plan was to clear cut the forest, expand at a golf course that was illegally built in the 1950s on our land. And in fact, we had a cemetery that's a 300-plus-year-old cemetery that exists. And when they built the first golf course, what they did is they built a road and they boxed it in. And it was so packed in there, because I remember I would volunteer when people would die, and we'd have to dig a hole, and we'd hit like 4 or 5 graves going down. You have like 300 plus years of people being buried in a lot that's smaller than the city block. So you can just imagine that the different amounts of people who were buried there, the disrespect that is to disturb them. And in my culture, the dead are venerated. They're very important. You know, the dead, they're not gone. They're still here. We still respect and honor them. We respect them like we do an elder, even more so, because they're not here any longer. They're moved on to the spirit world. So when they did that, that was the final indignity when they planned to do this. So we stood up, we organized ourselves, and we armed ourselves. We armed ourselves with whatever we can get a hold of. Some of us were able to afford buying AK-47s, which were legally bought in Montreal gun stores. So they tried to make a connection that we got this like international terrorist link that we were able to get these weapons, but they were bought legally. I bought mine legally in the Montreal store. You know, it just happened to be an AK-47. You know, but anyways, that's another story altogether. But we stood up and we resisted and we fought them off that summer, and it was a beautiful day. And we're reaching the 20th anniversary of that actually this year. This July will be 20 years, and the issue is still unresolved. Still remains as it is, status quo. And the Canadian government continually throwing money in the situation. Well, money is a bad bandage. I've used that analogy so much. It's a bad bandage. It doesn't cover up the bleeding. In fact, it causes the bleeding. And where we've gotten nowhere with this situation in Ganasadaga. And in fact, it's getting worse. 1990 did a lot of positive things for other Native communities in Canada. It opened a lot of people's eyes to the situation of Native people in Canada. But the problem is, like again, it boils down to money and funding in Ottawa's ignorance as far as what we need. We don't need their guidance. We have our own ways and systems of doing things, but they constantly impose their form of governance on us. They have their colonial governments, which still exist within our communities, under the guise of Indigenous government or band council government under the Indian Act. We have laws. You know, I hear a lot of people, like, it makes me very angry when, especially when I read the French media, they always talk, there's like the double standard with Indians. Oh yeah, there is, definitely is. You know, there's the haves and the have-nots, and then we're part of the have-nots. And I hear people saying constantly, like, Indians have everything. That's interesting. If we have everything, why is it that we don't own any of these skyscrapers in the financial district in Montreal? Why is it that there's no Indian that owns any of these big financial institutions in North America? We have everything. We're spoiled. But we don't own, we don't have the means to production. We lack the monopoly of violence. You know, we have everything, really. These are the same people that are producing newspapers in Montreal and in Canada. And these newspapers are owned by companies like Kruger, Bitsby Consolidated. So it's within their interest to marginalize Native people within Canada. I'll touch on one subject that's very important to be looking into. I think people in Montreal have to tune into this a little more, is the current situation in Ganasadaga with mining. I think it was about maybe 30 years ago, they discovered a mineral called niobium. Niobium is a mineral that's used in military industries. It's a mineral that lightens and hardens steel. It's used for armor, for military applications of different sorts. And they plan on opening up a mine within the bounds of Ganasadaga that promises to destroy the water table by contaminating it with radioactive tailings and runoff. Because when you find niobium, you find uranium. They kind of go hand in hand. It's like salt and pepper. Same thing. You can't find niobium without finding uranium. And currently we're fighting this, and there's not only the Mohawks of Ganasadaga, but there's non-native farmers who are in the surrounding area some of which are growing organically, some of which are growing fruits, the things we eat, the things you and I eat. And they're threatening these people with destroying their ability to not only make a living, but to grow the food we eat, at the same time destroying the land that belongs to the Mohawks of Ganasadaga. I think it's high time that we organize more amongst ourselves like we're doing right now. And we have to really stay strong and stay solid with each other. And I think it's just great that to see the people here, you know, how do we start to make a difference? We make a difference by the dialogue that we're sharing today. And on that note, I'll hand the mic over to my friends here from the other nations. Nyawa Goa. Thank you.